Now, the crisis of leadership, tonight's topic, is of great interest and could be tackled in a number of different ways. We could talk about the leadership of the country being in crisis. We could talk about the challenge of leadership during a crisis, or we could even talk about the crises that we face when taking on the mantle of leadership. There may well be other options, but I think if we cover at least those three tonight, we'll be doing very well. Even a cursory office conversation will reveal a general feeling of unease around leadership. The global community was shocked at the refusal of the Southern African leadership to even acknowledge the existence of HIV/AIDS, thus denying millions of innocents access to antiretrovirals. President Obama, now returned to the White House for a second term, is facing huge challenges as he leads America over the next 4 years. But what about the leadership crises of the presidential impeachments in 74 of Nixon and in 98 of Clinton? Remember these Australian political clangers. By 1990, no Australian child will be in poverty. What about this one? I pledge to never, ever introduce the GST. Or there will be no carbon tax under a government I lead. Then there are those who go from hero to zero in the sports arena. Tiger Woods, Mike Tyson, Lance Armstrong. To say nothing of the abuse and betrayal that we hear of by some church leaders. Were these people tried in the crisis, the fire of crisis, and found wanting? Do we expect too much from our leadership or our heroes? Or do we, in fact, expect too little of them, letting them off the hook when they come with tears and penitence? Well, time now to formally introduce one of our guest speakers tonight. John holds a Master's of Arts degree from Sydney University. In 1989, he was elected to the House of Representatives as a member of the National Party. In 1992, he was appointed to the opposition front bench. In 1993, elected deputy leader of the National Party. And in 1996, when the Liberal Party under John Howard formed a coalition government with the National Party, John took the primary industries and energy portfolio. In 1999, he was elected leader of the National Party when Tim Fischer retired and thus became the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. He inherited a party in decline facing a series of difficult policy challenges, including the privatisation of Telstra. John was thrust into even greater responsibility on that fateful day in September 2001. As Deputy Prime Minister, he was entrusted with leading our nation during those first traumatic days of uncertainty while John Howard was in lockdown in Washington. Talk about crisis of leadership. John, what would you say constitutes good leadership?
I think the essence of leadership has to do with seeing responsibility, because it's very easy to pretend it's not there, and then stepping up to the mark. Have we got a bounce back with the sound? We haven't. Okay, so you're all comfortable with it? Well, that's great. A definition of leadership that I've always quite liked was Henry Ford II. He said, the leader is a man who firstly has the ability to form a vision, to see what needs to be done, what the problem is and what needs to be done. Secondly, a man or a woman. I'm sorry, that was a terrible thing to say. I've just got half the audience offside and the interviewer. That was a big mistake.
That's right. We'll
you
let
can tell
off.
I'm out of practice.
That's once.
Someone who can see, a man or a woman who can see what needs to be done, what the problem is, what needs to be done. Secondly, can explain and articulate what needs to be done to others, and thirdly, has about them the personal qualities that will encourage those people to work with them. So the sort of person that you want to work with, will be somebody, firstly, that's not a hypocrite, that would do him or herself what it is that they're asking you to do. Secondly, somebody that you feel you can trust is a person of integrity. Thirdly, very importantly, I think, a person who has empathy for you, and that's where the service model comes in. I mean, Adolf Hitler had a vision and he was able to explain it and horrifically was able to get people to work with him. So he's an effective leader. But if you want to be a good leader, then one of the great characteristics is that you'll want to serve. Others will sense your empathy and your compassion. I think the amazing thing is that if we stop and think about it, probably no one would disagree with that. And yet I've never met anybody who actually really meets that test. And when we're with the boys today, the reading that we used in the induction service was from the second half of Romans 12, how we ought to live. You know, don't repay evil for evil. Honour others above yourself. True love is sacrificial, yet we're not able to do it.
You mentioned Hitler on the way through. Who would be some leaders in history that you would love to sit down and have dinner with?
Well, of course, I was deputy to John Howard, and I remember once at a lunch at the lodge for newcomers. David Fawcett might have been there. It was about the time you first came in. Senator David Fawcett is here, and it's lovely to catch up with him because he's a man of integrity in the public arena. I'm not just saying that because he's here. He is. I've seen him in action. You know, you've got a fine man in that. You do have good people in public life in this country. And it's easy to be cynical. But as John Howard moved around the tables, our table was having that very debate. There was a bunch of new people, and I was hosting the table, and there were new members and senators there. And John Howard said, you know, and they said, they'd all been talking about who, you know, Washington, Churchill, Wilberforce, the sort of names that came up, Menzies. But John Howard said that his choice would be, his words, Jesus of Nazareth. And he'd be my first choice. He's plainly the most significant human being who's ever walked the surface of the earth. Now, I believe he was more than that. But no one's had a greater influence on the passage of human history. And he would be a very interesting person, the founder of Christianity, to talk to.
You mentioned Wilberforce. Why William Wilberforce?
Wilberforce is a victim of his own success. I think he's the most influential person in Western history the last 300 or 400 years. He was a man who led the charge against the slave trade, a man from a very wealthy, privileged background, Hull in the north of England, went through Oxford, into the Parliament in his early 20s, was a friend of Prime Ministers, could have been a Prime Minister, was seen as a potential Prime Minister. He was converted to Christianity deeply and profoundly, went away and studied when the Parliament wasn't sitting. They must have had plenty of time off. Became a great theologian, wrote an utterly brilliant book. You can still buy a modern translation of it today called Real Christianity. That's a shorthand title. Became engaged in major campaigns to clean up public life in England, because it was a very, very corrupt place and a very uneven society, very like the one we live in increasingly today, where there's this terrible break of confidence between electors and elected and the people at the top of society and the bottom. And, of course, the thing he's most remembered for was that he was persuaded by John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, to spearhead the campaign in the Parliament against slavery. And that campaign ultimately worked. We don't realise how significant that was. We airbrush it out. One of the things that too many of the people who run our school curriculums do now, I think, is that they want to erase too many of the good people. I mean, I'll be really blunt with you. I find it amazing that the Australian curriculum that is now being put forward for the teaching of history will teach our kids more about Ellie McPherson than it will about the greatest human rights campaigner that our society has ever seen. And the American historian Hochschild, who's not a believer, he's a secular writer, claims that when Wilberforce began his campaign, 3/4 of the world's population were slaves. If you count the Indian arrangements, the caste system, they had no freedom, economic or social. 3/4 of the world. And the African slave trade was ended. Eventually the slaves themselves were set free. The British Parliament nearly broke itself paying compensation not to the people who had been enslaved, but to the wealthy slave owners who had given up their goods and chattels. And Hochschild argues, Metaxas argues, and I think I love history, they're great historians, that that was the rise of what we call a social conscience. It's completely shaped everything, even our welfare systems. It is radical Christianity saying, doesn't matter your gender, the colour of your skin, your economic power, even if you're voiceless, you have dignity and it ought to be respected. That's revolutionary stuff. Anybody who tells you that Christianity is reactionary and inward-looking and conservative and negative doesn't understand history, let alone Christianity.
John, do you think it's appropriate that
You'll have to shorten some of the questions now, won't you? I talked to you.
Sorry, I'll keep them briefer. Do you think it's appropriate that we hold those in leadership to a higher standard than ourselves? We seem scandalised when there's a fall from grace. Is it appropriate that we do expect them to maintain a higher standard?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But there's two questions that immediately arise. Why are we not applying the standards to ourselves that we expect them to display? There's a hypocrisy in that, isn't there? And the other thing we need to be aware of, you know what the problem with politicians is, don't you? Somebody got it. I heard it over here. They're human. They're people. Aren't they? And I'll tell you something, they reflect us and our values and our aspirations, particularly in a democracy. So I say to people when they say we're really troubled, I say, I understand that, but realise you're looking in a mirror. Sorry to be blunt, but you are. And, you know, are you going to ask a question about the national debate at the moment?
No, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Who's running this interview anyway? You know, if you look at the way we now debate, people everywhere I go in the streets, people want to raise what's happened in the parliament. And it's very tempting to be all smug and say, we were like that. But I don't want to go there. And you've said that everyone's talking about it. It's a Western-wide disease, not just Australia, okay? Greg Sheridan is probably the premier foreign affairs writer in this country, and he commented a couple of years ago in the context of the GFC, that every Western country except Australia faces a debt crisis. And by the way, we will soon if we keep going the way we are. And every Western country, including Australia, has a crisis of confidence in its leadership. So let's just look at one aspect of this I'd like you to consider. If we're getting bad policy outcomes, that's because we've got a bad debate. Okay? Bad policy comes from bad debate. We have a bad debate at every level in this country, characterised firstly by the fact we don't know what a debate is. They're now slanging matches. They're highly personalised. We shout from one another from the rooftops. You get as far apart as you possibly can, you abuse the other person. And you know what? Social media is making it even worse. What people say behind the anonymity of the keyboard to one another and the language they use is disgraceful, I regret to say. And as a parent, I'm really worried that our kids are showing us a whole new way to make it even harder. So that's point one. It's not a debate. It's a shouting match. Point two is that in an age of moral relativism and situational ethics where we don't think there are any great truths anymore, the arguments are not weighed on their merits even when the merits are introduced. We weigh the arguments on whoever's most in sync with the popular opinion of the day, and who's shouting loudest, and who can intimidate others. And that's the third point. Good people of integrity and decency who are trying to do better are frightened away from participating in the public debate or going into public life because they know that those who dictate the narrative, the intelligentsia of today, and this is not exclusive, but the intelligentsia broadly means, sorry, Carrie, the media, academia, political leadership, those who sort of are prominent in the debate of the day. I reckon ordinary men and women in this country, many of them people of great integrity and ability who want to see a better debate, they think, I'd like to contribute to that debate, but I'm not going to. Because if the people who run the debate today think that they disagree with that, they'll not only burn the idea off, I'll be condemned with it. And that's the price we're paying for the loss of our Christian belief. A Christian should be able to say, I may disagree with you, but I'll defend to the hilt your right to say it because I respect your humanity. Now, we've lost that in the West. It's part and parcel of what we are throwing away with our determination, particularly in the intelligentsia, to secularise our society to a ridiculous degree, a frightening degree. And we should have learnt from our history that when we say we can do it better without God, we're about to make a complete goose of ourselves. That's the story of our culture. The commies said they could run societies better without God, didn't they? And look at the misery they visited on people. And then the fascists, the right-wing version of how we can do it better without God, 60 million people dead in the Second World War, the gas chambers. When we're not accountable to a higher order and when we write other people off, well, that's when you get a breaking up of the social order and disastrous political outcomes. You do not get good policy outcomes if you don't have a high-quality debate. And the only rule should be civility. Treat one another with respect. I'll shut up now.
I read an interesting quote from Oz Guinness's book, A Free People's Suicide. He said, sustainable freedom depends on the character of the rulers and the ruled alike, and on the vital trust between them, both of which are far more than a matter of law.
He's a brilliant guy. How many of you have read any of Oz Guinness's books? Brilliant guy. I tell you what, if you're not a reader or you want to get an introduction to him, marvellous technology, just go to YouTube, Oz Guinness. Find him on something like Truth, The Virtue of Truth, and this sort of subject. And what he said there, he's absolutely right. This GFC threatens the West like no other thing. Let me give you an illustration. The debts in Europe and the forward liabilities that the baby boomers, by voting pensions and entitlements for themselves that their children are going to pay, not them, they themselves, have mortgaged their kids' future. It is selfishness personified. You know, we think we've moved beyond sin. And what we've done is to sell our kids' future down the drain. We've actually... The welfare arrangements in Europe are so over the top. They are not a system of transferring wealth from today's haves, the people who have money, to the people who don't. It's robbing their children. And a young German at the age of 20 entering the workforce today, by the time he's 50, he or she is 50, will be forking out 75% of their income in taxes to pay for the benefits that their parents and grandparents have voted for themselves. That is intergenerational theft on a vast scale. And it's the sort of thing, it comes from a moral issue, you see. It's self-obsession. It's all about me. You heard that in an ad? Advertising industry knows how we think. We've become very selfish, very self-obsessed. We're age of cheap credit. We borrow to the hilt personally. And when we can't borrow anymore, we make governments do it on our behalf because we say to the pollies, you give us this, that or the other and we'll reward you. You know, it's not all their fault. They offer too much, we demand too much. And if governments can't afford it, then they start to borrow. And guess what? Our kids have got to pay for it. Now, we haven't gone too far down that road yet in this country. We're one of the only Western countries that hasn't. And that is an enormous blessing for our kids. But I tell you what, the test's there. Are we going to be able to hold the line? Are we mature enough to learn the lessons from what that same writer, what Greg Sheridan... No, sorry, it was Paul Kelly. Paul Kelly wrote in The Australian... He called it shattered Europe with its mushy welfare dependency, look after everybody, cradle to grave stuff, or crippled America. We don't have to go either way in this country, but the jury's out on whether we can lift our leadership standards, both sides of the divide, the elected and the electors, to learn the lessons.
We had a question from Alicia on social media, and she said, how does a leader balance their convictions against being consultative and hearing the majority opinion around you?
It's a very good question. Is Alicia here? Well, she's not here.
She's being anonymous behind her keyboard.
Oh. Look, I think with great difficulty. I think for men and women of great courage and conviction now, the public square has become a place where they don't feel welcome. Remember what I said earlier about having your ideas burnt off? and then you're rejected and demonised if you've got an unpopular idea. And I think that's holding back. You know, I have people saying everywhere, we wish we had more good people representing us. But we're making it nearly, we're discouraging. In fact, I was with a group of businessmen, 28 of them, around a table with the Secretary of Treasury, Martin Parkinson, one of these boardroom lunches in Sydney the other day. And all those business leaders were saying, we've got to get the politicians to do this, we've got to get the politicians to do that, we've got to teach them to be all the things that you would say. And then they looked at me and said, how can we do that? And I looked at them and I said, there's 28 of you, you're all skilled and capable people, you all have children, you've all given them high quality educations. How many of you have suggested to them that they're good and capable kids and their country needs them in public service? They got the point.
Dare we ask how many said they had?
None. There was silence. We don't do it, do we? We say, no, it's got beyond us. We don't want to. So I think, to be blunt, what we need is the electorate to be more willing. And this requires the media, by the way, I think, to filter, or that's the wrong word, perhaps they filter too much, is to better reflect the men and women who are serving with integrity. That's why I unashamedly say you've got one in your midst here tonight, in David Fawcett. He's a man of obvious integrity and decency and commitment to you as the people he represents. You need to know that. But you're not told that in the media, are you? The media is so cynical. Sorry to have to say this, but they are. They just slate them all. They write them all off. So you get the message, how are you meant to choose and decide? Well, we need to know more, and then we need to more positively reinforce the people who are talking about serving their country, not just trying to win your vote, because they are different things. You know, one of the things I used to find in politics, you'd make a tough decision, and the people who agreed with it say, good on you, John, you're a leader. And the people who disagreed with it, oh, John, you'll never make it as a leader. Without considering the merits of what we've done, we need to be more discerning. Otherwise, no one's going to step up to the plate. I want to just emphasise again, this is a Western-wide disease. We don't have it as badly as a lot of other countries do, but time is ticking out for us.
Just before we invite Julia to join us, I think no leadership debate, particularly about public life, is quite complete without some words of wisdom from Sir Humphrey, from Yes Minister. He spoke of taking a courageous decision, which was actually a euphemism for sheer lunacy or political suicide. Have you ever had to take a courageous decision?
I remember discovering that bureaucrats have a sense of humour. When I became Minister for Primary Industries, there was something I wanted to do in the wool industry, which, you know, was in diabolical shape at the time. And the Department of Primary Industries and Energy's sort of top people were there in front of me, and I floated this idea. There was deathly silence, and the secretary of the department just said, that would be very courageous, Minister.
I think on that note, there's a question from the floor. Did you do it?
No.
But courageous.
Look, yeah, I mean, on the question of courage, yeah, no, many times I ran gauntlets. I mean, I was so radical, I actually believed, even coming from my party, that if we could find the right way to do it, this will shock you. I didn't believe that we should keep Telstra in public hands. I believe that we should set up a future fund, the very thing that we did with it, to help pay the pensions of retiring military and public service people. You know that's what it's there for. Because I reckon that would be a better investment for Australia's children than owning a telephone company. Now, that was, not many of my friends accepted that. And for me personally, that required a lot of courage. But that was my position.
On that note, let's welcome Julia up. Thanks, Julia. Julia, you've been one half of the very successful 26-year-long, thus far, marriage, a friendship and a partnership. What were the impressions?
Is it really that long?
It is, darling. Sorry.
Doesn't seem it.
What were your impressions on first meeting this man of action?
Well, that's quite a story. I'd actually been in a play the night before I met John, and so I had long hair at the time, and my hair had been in ringlets. I'd lots of stage makeup, and I'd gone to bed very late, very late. And as you lay on the pillow, crunch, 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 as your hair went through. And when I woke up in the morning, I had a knock on the door from my flatmate's fiancé, who had been to church and had come home from church with a friend. And he said, "Julia, there's someone here to meet you. Come on, come on out." So I struggle out of bed, stage makeup dripping off my chin, hair like the wreck of the Hesperus out every direction from this revolting ringlets. And I pull down a big jumper over my nightie, open the door, and there's this really handsome man in the kitchen. And I thought, blew that one. So, yes. Mm.
John, what were your impressions driving back to the farm after having met this vision?
I just told myself that I'd describe the vision as exotic. But look, I'd have to be honest with you and say that I preface this remark because I actually don't know that there is such a thing as love at first sight. I don't know whether that does really exist. But I went home, drive home, convinced that if I could convince her, Julia was the girl I wanted to marry. I had a few fingernail-biting months after that because it took a little while to persuade Julia that I was worth going ballooning with. Because that's actually what we did. It got serious when we went ballooning in the Hunter Valley.
There was a little moment where she was trying to convince you of something early on. I think a harbourside stroll, Julia. Didn't quite go to plan.
Oh, yes, that's right. We actually went for a walk and it was out on Dobroyd Point, which if you know that area, it's actually got some quite steep little patches in Sydney. And I'd gone down a little steep patch and said, "Come on down this way, John. You know, this is where we're going to go." So down I went and John said, "No, I'm not going down there." And I looked up at him and I thought, what a wimp. "Why would you come down here?" So I've got my riding boots on. They've got rubber soles. They slip. I'm not going down there. And I said, "Come on, John." Sorry, they've got leather soles. I said, come on down. "No," he said. And he headed off in the other direction. And I thought, well, he's not going to do what I've asked him to do. This isn't so good. Well, I must confess, I got home that day and Dad said, my father said, "And darling, how did the day go?" And I said, "It was really nice, you know, it went quite well. Except Dad, he wouldn't come down this hill when I said, come on down this way. He wouldn't come down that way." And Dad said, "Good."
I've enjoyed a great relationship with my father-in-law ever since.
So, Julia, to what extent do you think that experience has shaped your relationship over the years?
Well, I guess I think it's really important to... I'm a fairly... He's tamed me. I think leadership's an interesting thing, isn't it? They say that women are actually looking for love in a relationship and men are looking for respect. And particularly in the Bible, it actually, when they talk about that love passage about relationships, it doesn't say that men love your wives when they're being lovely. It says love your wives even when they're unlovely. And it says to women, honour your husbands, not just if they deserve honour, but honour your husbands. And I think probably I needed to learn that, and that's probably been something that we've learnt through our relationship a bit.
How has your shared individual faith shaped your relationship?
I guess I'd have to say God first, and then my husband, and then the rest of the family, the children, and put them in that order, and it seems to work a bit better because we can so often get to the stage where, you know, what about me comes out all the time. But if you're thinking at those moments when you're most feeling as though I want to be noticed, or I need some time, or I'd love to have a holiday, or whatever it is, if you can think then and actually flick the switch in your mind and say, no, how can I actually do something to help my husband or my children, you actually end up much happier and better. And I think that's that giving that Christ talks about. So if you can have your relationship with God right, then often the relationships that you have around you They're not always easy, but it helps you to make them work a bit better.
John, how would you say your personal faith has shaped your leadership inside the home?
Look, I think it's about commitment. It's about being intentional. Firstly, there's a structure for it. As a Christian, I believe that a man and a woman are uniquely and wonderfully different. Not unequal at all. Of equal weight and importance, but different. And that they mesh together in an extraordinary way. So I say rejoice in the difference. I mean, there are times when you think, I just don't understand these girls, darling. We've got three daughters. I can understand our son, but I can't understand. You know, and there isn't a bloke in the room. No, you. The unfortunate thing about that is that you girls all seem to get us. You understand us. We must be pretty transparent. Easily read or something. But certainly, there's a framework. Secondly, there is, anyone who has met Christ understands that Christ opens the door to really being able to recognise the other person's worth, to love, to the other person's dignity, to understanding that you don't play lightly with another person's emotions and their lives. They matter. And I can't lord it over Julia, you know, and expect God to honour that. Look, I think, you know, to share things, the other thing is sharing things at a very deep level, a commonality of belief and of purpose and of commitment to others. Even when it fails, you've got that bedrock to go back to. And, you know, look, I fail daily. I'm basically saying to you, do as I say, not as I do, okay?
Julia, how would you sum up John's public leadership?
Sometimes John would come home and he'd say to me, oh, darling, I'm just not clever enough. There's so many people in Parliament that just can run rings around me with their intellect. And I'd say to him, darling, you know, I'd rather have a wise man lead me than a clever one. And I think probably, being a biased wife, I think I probably have a very wise husband.
So your worst fears are all confirmed. I'm actually pretty dumb.
Julia, how are you impacted by John's public life in the home or with the family?
It's a pretty hard one. We have a farm. We lived on the farm when we were first married. We actually were married for... Our first child was born on... was due on our wedding anniversary, our first wedding anniversary, and she was 8 months old when we went into politics. So we'd only been married for a year and a half when we went into politics. And we had our other children while we were in politics. It's a fairly isolated farm. We're 80 kilometres from the town that we do our grocery shopping in. There's a little village between that where there's a little school. The kids had a 70-kilometre bus ride to kindergarten. And so we're a little bit away from everything. The electorate, when we first went into politics, is the size of England. Went from, if you know New South Wales geography, but it went from Muswellbrook up to the Queensland border. It was a bit like a tooth, actually, at one stage. It was very wide up the top and came down in these two little roots, I guess, of the tooth. And big area. So it was quite a lot of time on my own. We actually got to the stage when our third child was born. Actually, she gave us the best newspaper headline we ever had because she was born bang smack in the middle of election day. 1993.
I was there.
He did very well with all of them. And we got the best newspaper headline, National's wife goes to Labor on election day. Yeah. So We actually decided after that election, it was the election after that that we went into government, and we decided to then move with John to Canberra so that we could be with him a bit, because we got to the stage where he was at home one weeknight and then home on the weekends, and we'd do endless rounds of functions over the weekends. But it was really quite hard on the family. The kids were all still quite little. And so when our youngest, our fourth, was about 10 months old, we moved to Canberra. So he had, you know, tiny little kids. And that helped us to cope down there.
It was a time just after September 11 when, or around that time, when John was leading Australia as Deputy Prime Minister, there was talk of evacuating families of leaders into embassies.
Yes, yes, there was. In fact, it's quite a funny story. We actually, John was in Canberra and I was up on the farm, and Alexander Downer's press secretary rang me up and said, "You've got to turn the television on. You won't believe me if you don't. It's not a horror movie. It's actually really happening, and I need to find out where John is." And I told him where he was, and turned on the television, and just in time to watch the second tower being flown into. And so you do irrational things, I suppose. I thought, well, this is big. This is really big. And, you know, here am I out in the middle of nowhere. So I ran and got each of the four children and put them in the double bed. And we lay there in bed with the four kids. And I thought, well, you know, that's not going to really help anything, but at least they're all with me. And I woke up in the morning, and my son, who was about eight at the time, sat up in bed and said, "What are we doing in here, Mum?" And I said, "Well, you know, quite a big thing happened last night." And I was trying to explain to them that the... in as gentle terms as I could, what happened. And he said, "So, Mum, you put us in here because you think..." Well, John had used to charter planes, these little twin-engine planes with about four seats in them, tear off around the electorate sometimes. And the pilot was called Mr. McAllister. So Nick said, "You really think someone's going to hijack Mr. McAllister's plane and fly into Newstead?" "No, Nick." But, yeah, it was a bit of a scary time.
John, what style of leadership sits most comfortably with you?
Wise leadership, I think. Considered, measured, non-glory-seeking, non-publicity-seeking. And the great clash in a democracy like ours, of course, in a leadership model like ours, is that you've always got to sell a message and you've always got to be on the media. And it's got worse and worse in the hours of the 24-hour cycle. I have to say that I recently read... I wonder whether any of you have read Heather Henderson's Letters from My Father. She was Menzies' daughter. Anyone read it? It's a brilliant book. You know, and the dignity of that man and the way in which he related to his family... and the way in which he would make his points of disagreement with others on, you know, when he was writing to his letter, to his daughter, about people on the other side. And, you know, I mean, in politics, I remember when I was sitting quietly beside Ian Sinclair, who has been the member for New England and a very prominent member of the Fraser-Anthony government, you know, and he just said, "Now, young fellow," he said, "you need to understand that those people over there," which was the other side of politics, you see, he said, "they're the opposition. So these people around here are the enemy." The way Menzies spoke of the people in the game with him, you know, there was a decency and a respect for their humanity, even when he fiercely disagreed with their ideas. I respect that. But look, ultimately, I'd have to say that what I respect most, the leadership I respect most, is that of the servant modelship of Jesus Christ, both demonstrated and I think would demand of his followers that we try, however inadequately, to emulate. And, you know, all of you, if you stop and think about it, will have those incredible moments when funny little incidences that others mightn't have even noticed teach you great things. And for me, it was a university student. Look, I grew up in a fairly privileged home, plenty of hardship because of family tragedy, but a privileged home nonetheless, and went to a privileged school. And, you know, was very fortunate to, you know, be able to go to a good university. And I decided that I probably needed to learn a bit more about how society works. And I took myself off and I got a job as a mechanics labourer in a very rough garage in Sydney. There were about 7 or 8 blokes that worked in a place that essentially dismantled worn-out taxis. That's what we basically did. I was a grease jockey of the first order. And the fascinating thing happened when they everything went along swimmingly well with the other blokes until they found out that I hadn't been sent around by the local unemployment office. I was actually a uni student. A shock horror. What are they? And the boss, who was a wise old man, realised that this was a real problem for a lot of the other blokes. He put me with another young fella who's about my age. Now, the thing that I learnt from that young fella, you know, I mean, it was extraordinary, really. His relationships were an absolute mess. His home life was a mess. The whole thing, you know, his horizons were unbelievably limited. But as I got to know him, I was gently humiliated time and time again until I got to the point where I thought, if this bloke had had my opportunities in life, he'd have been a brain surgeon or prime minister or something. And that was a very humbling thing for me to learn. And it was a way, as I look back on it, God was teaching me something. And it was to stand me in great stead in politics because it helped me to really deeply understand, even when I didn't feel it, that even the constituent who most disagreed with me politically you know, I suppose I can say it. I mean, it's not political. It's just a simple matter of fact. I remember once being spat at by a teenage Aboriginal in the town of Walgett. And he said, "You whiteys," these were his exact words, "stole our country from us and we're going to make you bastards give it back now." And I remember thinking, there's no place for anger. Maybe polite disagreement. But this fella, before the Almighty, is just as important as I am. And I might be the Deputy Prime Minister of the country, but that doesn't matter a damn, in a way. It's irrelevant. So they were very valuable lessons that went to the heart of the leadership model that I tried, I'm sure, very inadequately to adapt. So I was never at ease with the attempts to portray the other side as demonic, if you know what I mean by that. I was very uncomfortable with that. So I'm not at all... You know, I don't resile from a fierce contest of ideas. I love that. I was hoping some of you will want a vigorous debate. It's the one thing I miss from public life. But I've learnt, and I'm very thankful that even though I've resisted learning it and I often forget it, that we have this great responsibility to respect the other person because their creator does.
John, what would you most like to be remembered for?
Well, can I say in one way it's nice to be forgotten, and it's always a bit of a shock when they sort of see people looking at you and you know, you sort of think, oh, I know what's going through their mind. They're trying to work out why they think they recognise me. So a lady said to me the other day, "Gee, I miss not seeing you play television on the television, play tennis on the television." My son and I went to South Africa. We had a great friend of ours over there. We went over on some points, accumulated points and what have you, a couple of weeks wandering around there. And there was a couple from South Australia, an older couple. And over breakfast in a garden in this sort of remote little country town, one of them was saying to the other one, the husband said to his wife, "By Jove, that bloke looks like John Anderson." And she said, "I know, dear. I've been I hope he hasn't noticed, but I've been staring at him, thinking how much he... But I've worked out he almost has, certainly has to be related, but if not him, he's too old." And then there was a lady in the reception line in Sydney where a charity, and Julia was with me, and they're all filing past. And this lovely lady, and I mean in no disrespect, I'd just love to share the story with her now, and I hope she doesn't, if she's ever heard me tell it, I hope she doesn't mind, but she had this look on her face, and I recognised the sign. She had something she wanted to say. And she was very tall, very elegant, still beautiful at 80 plus, like Julia will be, in about 70 years' time. And, you know, ermine coat, immaculate, which is a bit politically incorrect, but never mind. She shook my hand and got it out. She said, "Young man," which I thought was a pretty good start, actually. She said, "I know you've been in the media, and I know that, you know, I should know who you are because you're obviously well known. said, sweetie, I'm embarrassed to have to tell you, we actually have been introduced and I still can't remember your name. And you'll have to tell me who you are because you bear an uncanny, I've got to tell you, you bear an uncanny resemblance to that fellow John Anderson who used to be the Deputy Prime Minister. Look, you know, I think it's a vanity to want to be remembered. I just hope that people don't think of me in terms of he was a rogue or a scoundrel or whatever. I just hope they see that if nothing else, I was sincere in trying to make a contribution. I don't know if you can hope for more than that, or should hope for any more than that.
We're about to break for some drinks before we come back for questions, but I wanted to ask just one last question before we go to that break. You went into public life somewhat reluctantly. Have you got any advice for other reluctant leaders?
Stay away from it. No. Look, can I... well, maybe if I brought nothing else to it, it was a reluctance to do it. I was sort of... I felt... I suppose the way I used to sometimes put it was I couldn't stand on the sidelines and criticise the way the generals were running the war if I wasn't prepared to enlist as a private soldier. And that was the spirit I tried to take into it. And very often I'm asked by young people who are interested in politics, you know, how to go about it. And I usually, to be honest with you, try to dissuade them. When I meet somebody really exceptional, I sometimes say yes, and the characteristic I'm looking for, over and above, I mean, if I think they've got some of the raw materials, the characteristic I'm actually looking for is humility. And there's a brilliant book written by John Dixon from the Centre for Public Christianity in Sydney called Humilitas. Can I recommend it to you? Humilitas. And it's about the humble leader in the past and today. And that's the quality that most impresses me. It's partly cultural. My father was an Edwardian sort of Australian. I mean, I'm sixth generation on my mother's side. And, you know, we're sort of dear old Scots. My name is Anderson, you know, that's my heritage. I'm from that little place in the drizzly sort of wet part of the UK, or the most drizzly and the wettest part of it. And he had this detestation of men who were on themselves. That's part of it. But the real issue for me is that if we really understand who we are and we really understand who Christ is, there's no room for pride.
Thank you. We are going to take a 5-minute break now, but and we'll encourage you to head over, grab a drink at the bar, come back. I'll clang the bell or something, but we need to come back. Use this time to ponder some questions because we will give you a good 15 minutes or so of questions from the floor. Both John and Julia will be back up here. But in the meantime, can you please thank John and Julia for their contributions so far? Excellent. All right, we've got a number of questions from the floor on the yellow pieces of paper, but please do keep thinking through your questions. We're happy to take questions from the floor, and Craig has a microphone, so if you do want to ask a question, just put your hand up. Just a little bit of housekeeping for the process so that we all get to hear your question. Can you keep your hand up until I acknowledge you and Craig gets to you with the microphone? That would be really helpful. If I could also... Here's Craig with the microphone. I'd also like you to keep your questions to questions rather than just sharing an opinion. We won't have enough time to all do that tonight in a public setting. So if I don't sniff a question coming soon, don't be offended, but I will interrupt you and ask for your question. I think that will help to keep things flowing. And I think we'll start off with a couple of the written questions. So far, we've got quite a lot of questions for John, but we'd love some questions for Julia, so please keep that in mind as well. Now, John, considering the lack of leadership in our government and in all parties, plus the poor perspective from the media, is there any hope for non-political and constructive debate in our parliamentary system?
It's a very good question, and it's a very important one. I'd want to emphasise again that there are, in all parties, I'm sure even in the Greens, they're good people of good intent. And I shouldn't be flippant about that. And we should look for them. There will be. And they need to be respected and encouraged and worked with. And if anything I said before about you know, implying that I discourage young people, nothing could be further from the truth. If you're a good, capable person who wants to make a contribution, then please do it. And we all need to then try and recognise people who are well-motivated, who can be trusted, even if we don't agree with their particular set of policies, to get in there and vigorously have their say. But the point that I would want to make is that there's a strange sense in which we miss the point that I made earlier, I think, which is that the problem with politicians, remember I made that flippant comment, is that they're people. We need to realise that this problem of the breakdown of civility, Os Guinness talks about it, we're eating ourselves out from within. It's not as if the communists won the Cold War or the Nazis won the Second World War. We've been the freest, most prosperous, most fortunate societies that the globe has ever seen, and yet we're eating ourselves out from within, and nowhere is that better reflected than the breakdown of the debate, and the debate has broken down because of a lack of civility. And the civility is broken down, I'm sorry to say that some of you will disagree with this, but I deeply and profoundly believe that in our culture the civility came from the Christian worldview that says that the little guy matters. That's why Wilberforce is such a hero to me. The Chinese government, the atheist regime in Beijing, dislikes the house church movement because they believe that the house church movement will see Christians agitating for the rule of law and for democracy because the little person matters. It's about the raising of individual conscience. We don't understand our own history. And it's no wonder that civility is breaking down in our culture because we've abandoned the thing that built it in the first place. And one of the privileges that I've had in a leadership role is meeting people of all beliefs and none and of all sorts of backgrounds and what have you. And the thing that strikes me is that there is something absolutely unique about the cultures that have a Christian heritage. And it's their emphasis on looking after the little person. Name me another cultural or belief system that has what we call a social conscience. You don't find it. So, can it be rebuilt? Of course it can. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we should all be striving for it. And if anything I've said today sounded negative, and yeah, I've said some pretty tough things, please, don't let me get away with wanting to discourage you. This really matters. We should all be seeking to make a contribution, to be civil debaters in the social media. We need to think about how we communicate with others, what messages we send our politicians. I often say to churches who say we feel powerless to influence, I said, have you built a relationship with your state and federal members? Have you actually told them you care about it? I mean, ring up their electorate offices and say, you know, we'd just like to send a group round from our church. And they'll say, yes. They won't be able to say no. What's it about? Oh, we just want to come and say who we are and offer our support and say we're... They'll fall off the other end of the phone. What, you just want to support us? Tell us you care about our job? Try it. Probably won't believe you.
Os Guinness said, we don't have to be worried about the wolves at the door, it's the termites in the floor.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very... Let me just say that. Can I say to you, I'm a passionate believer in parliamentary democracy and I love this country and I actually love Western civilization. There you go, I just lost all the modern academics who think our civilization's terrible and oppressive and it's dark and it's had a colonial past that's ruined others' lives and all the rest of it. Sure, it's had its faults, but I can't think of a better way of life than we've enjoyed thanks to democracy. I often used to say to the kids that came to Canberra, think of a great society you'd like to live in other than ours. That's, you know, or name me a society that has a rotten system of government that you would want to live in. And they never could. And yet 40% of our young people feel unwedded to democracy. What would they prefer, might I ask? What would they prefer? What's happened? Why have we lost sight with the great blessings that we've had? And so on that line, yeah, we are white-anting ourselves in through lack of belief in our culture and in ourselves and in our children and in the beliefs that drove the values, that drove the behaviour and the ethics that defined the West. And so we are vulnerable to the termites. If we could only recover the things that made us great, we would defeat the beasts at the door like the GFC quite quickly.
Here's another question for you, John. As an everyday Australian, what areas of contribution can influence positive leadership direction within business, politics and relationships?
Well, it depends on your worldview, doesn't it? It depends on your worldview. If you've swallowed... You know, politicians are pretty good at knowing what you think. These focus groups, you've all heard about those. Some of you might have even been polled. They find out what you're thinking. But they're nowhere near as good as the advertising industry. They're brilliant at it. The advertising industry is a multi-billion dollar business, and you think politicians try and manipulate you. What the advertising industry sells, a lot of it's just superstition, isn't it? Anybody really believe that they're going to have a better sex life if they buy Johnson shampoo over whatever? But we fall for it, don't we? Now, they know what you think. So when you see an ad with a hand pointing out of the page saying, look after the most important person in the world, you, and when you go to Canberra, city of 300,000 surrounded by reality, I've never said that in Canberra. And I saw the other day the two ad lines that most encapsulate what the advertising industry knows about where we our worldview at the moment. It said buy your retirement village in this wonderful new development because you deserve it and it's all about you. How can a society work if you've got 22 million Australians who are all the centre of their own universe? It can't work. Can we put it back together? Of course we can. Of course we can. How can you make a contribution? It begins, it begins with the way you treat your spouse, the way you treat your children, the way you treat your neighbour, the way you treat the people in the workplace, the way you think then about your society, the clubs you're involved in and the sporting institutions, the way you react to others in the pub, the way you talk about others, the way you communicate in the social media, the way you use your vote, who do you reward? The John Dixon, the fellow I mentioned a moment ago, Humilitas, the book, okay? I'm not on a commission, but buy it. He wrote a very interesting article prior to the last state election in Sydney. He said, do you think Australia might be a better place if, paraphrasing the love your neighbour as yourself, you cast your vote for your neighbour? Interesting point, isn't it?
Do we have any questions for Julia from the floor? I'm sure we do. They're just really still thinking about it.
I'm quite relieved.
Okay, here's another one. I am a non-Christian, in fact a non-believer. I like to think I have good morals and ethics and while in the workforce was a good leader. How do you reconcile my situation with your beliefs?
Well, the first thing to say is that, of course, I absolutely and totally respect your right to your position, whoever that was. And I appreciate the fact that, by implication, I think, by being here and by phrasing that, you're prepared to respect my position. And that's the basis of civility, isn't it? I think we'd agree on that. I think the second point I would say is that democracy is designed to accommodate our differences. And both of us have the right, in fact, I'd say more than the right, I'd say the responsibility to argue our respective positions. That's how we make our system work, isn't it? But to do so with civility on the basis of that respect I talked about. The third thing I would say is, let me very gently challenge you, because I'd love to have a full-blooded debate with you, but let me very gently challenge you. I've often thought about why is it, because I get this debate, I've got a nephew I'm very fond of, and he's often having a go at me as a Christian, who says, can't you be a good person without being a Christian? And of course, I answer, yes, you can. I know many Christians who sadly disgrace the things they say they believe in, and I know many people who say they don't have any time for God who seem to live very well. But then I stop and I think about it, how should we really live? How should we really live? I'm the greatest human being who walked the surface of the earth. Said a very profound thing to a very clever young lawyer who for once was not trying to entrap him. He asked a question in good faith. Teacher, you know, what are the great commandments? Because the Jews had hundreds and hundreds of them. And he answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind and soul, and love your neighbour as yourself. And against that standard, then probably the biggest area of difference is between us. I have to tell you, my friend, I would never describe myself as good or as moral. I try to be, but I know in truth I don't measure up. And I don't honestly know that, not by my standards, forget my standards, or Australia's standards or whatever. I'm sure by those standards you're a very fine person. But by God's standards, I'd ask you, I think that is the standard. And I wonder whether any of us live up to it. And because we can't live up to it, our society seems to be always so fractured. We find it so difficult to really make progress. And that's why I admire men like Wilberforce so much. He was this man who had everything to gain as a member of the very wealthy cream, the narrow cream at the top of his society, and yet chose to represent people who were not even acknowledged as human beings. Radical indeed. Radical indeed, a complete change of heart. And he was an unbelievably modest man. When you read his diaries, he chastised himself every night. And he often used to say, you know, they said in Parliament today, I was a great person, I'm paraphrasing, but I know underneath it all, I'm a selfish sod. And that's what I'm like, to tell you the truth.
A couple more questions that are quite similar. Any from the floor yet? Any hands? We want to get Craig running around with that microphone. Nothing yet? All right. Oh, yes, we do have a question right over on this other side of the room, Craig. Make your way that way, and I'll just ask John. There's a couple of questions that are quite similar here. Do politicians enter public life with good intentions only to be bogged down with the party line and not achieve what they originally entered for? And another question on a similar line. In your experience, what sort of compromises were asked of you as a politician?
Yeah, they're both very good questions, and I'm often asked both of them. I don't know that anybody's motives are ever totally pure or impure. I mean, I think that's true of us if we're honest with ourselves. But I certainly believe that many, many people enter politics with a deep desire to make a contribution. But again, it would track where we're at as a society. I'm trying to get a hold of a more up-to-date copy of it. And so when I talk about this, if you recognise what I'm talking about, you might be able to steer me in the direction of it. But there's been a tracking study of young men's attitudes in America from 1965 right through, one of these long-term things. And if you asked a young American male in 1965 in one of the Ivy League universities, that's where the studies were done, they're top universities, what he hoped to do with his life, the answer would typically be along the lines of, I hope to make a contribution, I hope to make the world a better place, to leave the world a better place for my life endeavours. If you ask them the same question today, the answer will be, I hope to find personal fulfilment. And when you delve into that, that means things like, I hope to marry somebody, if they marry at all, who will love me. And I hope to have children because they can love me. See this, what we've done? And then I come back to the point earlier, when our society becomes 22 million Australians who are all the centre of their own universe, you can't take a country forward. You have to have a mechanism for recognising the need to live collectively. Now, I'm a conservative. That normally sounds like a socialist language. I say they've both got it wrong at this level. And in essence, the key to it is understanding that if I matter as an individual, so do you. And I can't lord it over you. So I've got to respect your view, and we've got to find a way to rub this down together. Does that get knocked out of people in politics? Very often. Very often. Sometimes it's not by the political process. Can I be really frank about this? I'm trying to be even-handed here. Sometimes it's by dealing with constituents. You know? I once said to a used car salesman, I said, you know, I see in the latest survey, professions, you and your profession and I and my profession, we about equal peg for both bottom of respectability. I said, how do you cope with being
you know, at the bottom of the respectability pile. He said, I just remind myself of the people who come in and tell me that this car they want to trade is, you know, was their grandmother's and was only driven to church on Sundays and never taken out in the wet. And one look at it tells me that they're a complete fraud and the thing's been round the clock five times and it's on its third engine. And, you know, we're all in this together. Sorry to have to say it. Do we need to do better? All of us. I talk to myself first and foremost. We all can lift our games. We honestly can. And I say that to a group of people. I mean, I have no doubt that you are a terrific group of people. I mean, you're no insult at all. And I know from the conversations we've already had how committed to your fellow Australians many of you are. All of the ones that I've spoken here tonight are. But you'll also see that we can all do more and we've got to encourage others to do more. And as a Christian, I have to say to you, I think that this, you know, you've got to join the dots up. I repeat it again, the abandonment of our beliefs is what has led to the collapse in our values and the change in our behaviour and our ethics. And if there's one thing I want to say to you bluntly, don't misunderstand how serious that collapse in our behaviour and ethics has actually been. Survey of accountancy students in this country recently established that accountancy students, around half, if offered a sufficient bribe, when they begin their accounting course, would say, yes, I would deceive a customer. It rises as they go through their course, not falls. Choose your accountant. I've just got all the... Any accountants here? I'm sure you're in the tiny little band that's left at the top.
We've got time for one question. Now, I'm not sure if I have to ask John to do a short answer or you a short question, but we don't have long.
Short question. Tell us your opinion of the press as a Christian leader.
Yeah, look, someone asked me that earlier. I don't look, there are people in the press that I really deeply respect. You know, they really are. Quite a few. I'll nominate one, a man who I think actually is enormously insightful, a man of great integrity. You know, you shouldn't do that, but I'll just nominate one, just as evidence, and that would be Greg Sheridan. Okay? Now, look, there are others. But generally speaking, the surveys show that they are at the vanguard of what are called progressive values. Their values are out of sync with the broader community. And unfortunately, I do think they are a serious problem in that there are many subjects that they do not want to debate. So they essentially will ignore them and not take them seriously. So I think by far the most... I'll be frank about this and I hope I don't offend anyone. My personal view, and I think the research is quite clear, the biggest social issue confronting the West, including this country, is in fact fatherlessness. Okay? Now in America, 45% of children by the time they're five will be living in a single parent home. And it's nearly always the father that's missing. Britain it's about, and it's 70% in black communities. In Britain it's about 40%, in Australia it's well over 30% and climbing rapidly. Now we've had some brilliant research done in this country. A fellow called Professor Patrick Parkinson last year released a report that had been funded by ACL on the state of the debate in Australia. It is a really, really serious problem. And the left can't deny that. Think of the emphasis they put on the stolen generation. They can't deny the progressives, and the media would describe themselves as progressives, by and large. So they can't say these issues aren't important. Look what they did with the issue of the stolen generations. Parenting matters. And yet, they would have given 50 times as much airspace and print space to the issue of same-sex marriage. Now, regardless of your views on that latter, can I tell you that the issue for young Australians that is really important here is that far too many of them are grieving inside because dad isn't around. And there'll be people here who are touched by that, and I'm not meaning to be hurtful. I'm just saying it's a really important issue. There's a classic example of the sort of distortions you get because by and large the media don't want, not interested in that. They don't want to touch it because of where their values sit and the narrative they're running. and I've touched on one of the other issues, they are unbelievably reluctant to concede that any politician might be well motivated. Because as we've said here tonight, that's come up time and time again, regardless of what you think of their policy position, many are well motivated and do want to make a contribution and are high-minded. But you wouldn't know it, would you? Well, why wouldn't you know it? Where do you get your information from? So do I think, having said, yes, there are some terrific ones that I really do respect, as a pack, you know, I don't think the Western media now serve their task of lubricating the relationship between electors and elected properly. Now, I wouldn't lump them, I'd put them out on their own. I think a lot in this, what you might call the intelligentsia, are there with them. A lot of the people who have undue control over the national debate. And I think that is immensely frustrating to many intelligent, thoughtful Australians who want to have a say, but to go back to what I said earlier, feel that their ideas, if they don't fit the narrative, and the media's narrative is a very narrow one, then your ideas will get burnt off, and then you're a bad person, you're demonised because you've had an idea they disagree with. Is that a problem? Yeah, it's a very serious problem. That's what I think.
I would like to give Julia an opportunity to have the last word.
Well, I think probably the last word. I remember when we were in politics, we had a lovely man come and visit John every Tuesday morning and spend probably just under an hour with him to talk and pray with him. Very special fellow. And he used to say every Tuesday as he walked in two things. One I really liked. Well, I like both of these things. But he used to say, "Are you loving your wife?" Like that bit. But the one that I think is probably more important, and I think it's something that is for all of us, is he said, "Remember, there is an audience of one." And probably that's a good thing to think about at the end, not just for us who have been in politics where your perceptions count so much and so you're worried about what people out there really think and how they perceive you, but what really counts is your behaviour, whether it's washing up or whatever it's doing, but it's in front of our Heavenly Father, the audience of one.
John was about to say something. I did say Julia was having the last word.
I just wanted to say that all the humour's gone out of it, which is a great shame. And so it's not to detract from that, because that is the last word of a serious nature. You know, one of the tragedies is that in the old days, politics used to have a bit of fun about it, and I'm sure that helped. And my favourite yarn was a predecessor of mine, Sir Arthur Fadden, leader of the Country Party, one time treasurer. And in the 1949 election, where the issues were petrol and food rationing left over from the Second World War and bank nationalisation, he was in a little country town in what one day became my electorate called Warrialda. Anybody been to Warrialda? It's a long way from... There you go. And in those days, no television. They didn't even all have radios. The politician in town was entertainment. So the whole town turns out there's 1,000 of them there. An Artie, as they called him, was on his soapbox. We'll end petrol rationing. We won't nationalise the banks. And there's an old conservative moralist down the back calling out, "Don't want to know about that. What's your policy on contraception?" It was the moral issue of the day. We forget how these things move on. And Artie would sort of move on again, you know, "We will end petrol. We'll get your butter ration lifted." And he'd yell out, "We want to know about your policy on contraception." And Artie couldn't find a way to respond to this. And eventually, after about three quarters of an hour of heckling, the bloke asked the question in a way that Artie felt he could respond to. "Artie, you're carrying on all this stuff. We don't want to know about that. What's your policy on contraception? Do you believe in it or don't you?" And Artie says, "As a matter of fact, my good man, I do. And in your case, I'd make it retrospective."
Please thank John and Julia Anderson.